This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon survived votes of no confidence in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, today. That, along with a reported decision by Israel's attorney general not to indict him, may enable Sharon to press ahead on his plans to construct a physical barrier around Israeli territory and to withdraw Jewish settlements from Gaza and parts of the West Bank. Both aspects of that plan remain controversial, but for different reasons. Earlier today, the Israeli government announced the confiscation of thousands of acres of land that will be used for a segment of the barrier near a large West Bank settlement called Ariel. The seized territory is Palestinian farmland, and Palestinians say this is just the latest example of how construction of this barrier is being used to extend the Israeli border and restrict the growth of Arab communities. The government says the barrier is designed to protect against terrorists, and most Israelis support it. The Gaza withdrawal plan is controversial within Israel. Again, opinion polls show that most Israelis support it, but Prime Minister Sharon lost a vote in his own party, the Likud, only won approval from his cabinet after firing two hardline ministers, and if he's to go ahead, he may have to invite the rival Labour Party into his government. We focus today on the prospects of the Gaza withdrawal. Later in the program, the story of an Iraqi teenager who informed on insurgents, including his father. We'll ask why and about what will happen to him, plus your letters. But first, the politics of the Gaza pullout. If you have questions about what's happening and why, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a spokesman for some Israeli settlers about their objections and from a Palestinian minister, and we'll find out more about Gaza itself. But first, Matt Reese, the Jerusalem bureau chief for Time magazine, joins us on the phone from his office in Jerusalem for the latest news, and welcome to Talk of the Nation. Matt Reese, are you there?
Yeah, I know.
Hi. First, tell us a little bit about today's news. Again, it's reported that Israel's attorney general has decided not to indict Ariel Sharon, but that's not certain.
It's not certain. There are an awful lot of leaks of this nature that come up all the way from the very start of the investigation into this. What it looks like, according to these latest set of leaks, might happen is that the charges against Sharon, if he is indeed indicted, might go down a little from bribery, which is what he faces at the moment, to something that's a little more like not upholding public morality, which is still pretty bad if you're the prime minister. But on the other hand, it doesn't match up with the full scale of the bribery that he was accused of, and that, in fact, the state prosecutor has recommended that he be indicted for. It's also not certain that that decision will come this week. You know, Israeli journalists tend to seem quite certain of these things, but it's by no means certain that that will happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's say he does survive it. The votes today in the Knesset weren't about this bribery scandal, but rather about the Gaza withdrawal plan.
Because of that Gaza withdrawal plan, things on the Israeli political spectrum are shifting. For the first couple of years of this intifada, Sharon had rather thrived on nothing happening. That way he could say, it's all Arafat's fault, I don't have to deal with him for the time being. And his government, which was right-wing, won a further election because of that feeling that nothing could be done. Now, he himself has shifted and has started to say, if that's the case, if nothing can be done, we have to put ourselves in a more defensible position. That's essentially what his disengagement plan is all about. The right-wingers don't like that, and they're gradually pulling away from him, or even he is shedding them. It's happened in several stages. As you mentioned, he fired two ministers from right-wing parties. Half of this National Religious Party, which is also a settler party, has quit. A couple of ministers quit, but a couple stayed. And now, tonight, he's apparently considering firing a couple of ministers from his own Likud party who won't be supporting him on this. When I say that things are shifting, perhaps he's shifting towards a coalition with the Labour Party, which has said at the very least that even if it doesn't join the coalition, it will give him a safety net in votes on the disengagement plan. They'll support him, in which case he will have a majority. So he's shifting a little and trying to ride those shifts in the political landscape.
At the same time, the plan itself is changing. This would now not be a full and complete and immediate withdrawal, but rather phased over several stages.
Indeed. One of the prominent opponents of the plan on the left, Yossi Beilin, who was one of the architects of the Oslo Accords, said last night, we shouldn't really support this. It's a trick. You know, if Sharon was serious about pulling out, he could do it in 6 months at the most. So why is he talking about doing it next spring and then in next fall, spreading it over time? If he was really serious about doing it, and he has this Labour Party safety net, go ahead and do it. So there's still a lot of people on the left who aren't sure that Sharon is really going to do this. Moreover, a lot of people on the left believe they shouldn't be supporting a plan which is unilateral, which doesn't incorporate an agreement with the Palestinians. And that's one of the things which, as he moves along these shifting spectrum, Sharon is going to have to convince the left-wingers to support him on the basis of a unilateral agreement, which they've been very much opposed to in the past.
Now, on Friday, talking about the other side of that spectrum that he's engaged in, on Friday, Israel offered compensation of up to $300,000 per family to Jewish settlers in the Gaza Strip to encourage them to leave on their own without the use of military force, in other words, without being ejected. What's been the reaction to that plan among settlers?
Well, on the one hand, when you go to the settlers in Gaza, there's a surprising number of them, surprising to me, having been here for many years and written about settlers on many occasions, there's a surprising willingness to say, okay, I'll take the money. I think this is essentially a done deal. I'll take the money and I'll go. It's not happy, and who knows if when it actually comes to packing up their things and slinking out of the settlements while some of their neighbors stay behind, whether they'll actually be able to do it. But at the moment, it does look like, first of all, the Israeli public supports this. Sharon has this safety net. He will be able to do it. So a lot of settlers are starting to think, well, perhaps we should just go ahead. The figure that you mentioned, $300,000, is the average that's at least reported in the Israeli papers. There could be payments much bigger than that, payments smaller than that, and it could be over time, it could be that they get taxed on it or they don't get taxed on it. It's all very much up in the air. And indeed, those figures might be simply the Israeli finance ministry tossing out an extremely high number for how much this is going to cost in the hope that the Americans will pay for it, because obviously it's a very important part of the White House policy in the Middle East right now that this disengagement plan go ahead. And then, hopefully, down the line, President Bush's roadmap plan can be reintroduced. So it could be a little games playing there on the numbers, but it's clear that there are a lot of settlers that are ready to at least accept the idea of taking some money. Whether they will do it in July, which is when it might actually be possible for them to start doing it, or whether they'll wait until much closer to the date of the actual evacuation, which could be next year, that remains to be seen.
We're speaking with Matt Reese, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN@npr.org. And let's go to Herb, who's with us on the phone from Bridgeton, New Jersey.
Thank you. I'd like to ask a question.
Sure.
As most people over there know, the land that we're discussing in the Gaza Strip was purchased prior to 1948. In other words, before there was an Israel, when it was still the Palestine Mandate, by the Jewish National Fund. Now, if they abandon that land, are they going to trade that land for land of equal value owned by Arabs in the West Bank?
How's that going to work, Matt Reese, or has that been worked out yet?
Well, no, that certainly isn't entering the question here at the moment. The question of what land was owned before 48 and what wasn't, and the caller is quite right that there was a certain amount of that land in Gaza was already, for example, this one settlement, Kfar Darom, was there in the 20s. On the other hand, what people both in the political scene here and certainly in international dialogues on this have already pretty much accepted is Before 48, we're not even going to think about that. We're just going to talk about what was the situation in 1967 when Gaza and the West Bank were occupied by the Israelis as part of that the Six-Day War at that time. So the situation before 48 isn't really entering into any kind of dialogue at the moment.
Herb, you were trying to get in?
Yes, I would object to the use of occupied. After all, we're talking about a war going into...
I didn't say who started the war, Herb. I just said that that's the result of the war was that they occupied that land.
Yeah, I know. The war started in 1948, and the lines have been moving back and forth since then.
Yeah.
As you know, the treaty that called for the ceasefire in 1949 said the ceasefire lines are never to be considered a final border.
Well, that's part of the problem with now with the talking about the disengagement plan and where the fence goes. The Israelis, in building this fence, are also saying this isn't a political fence. It's just a security fence. We're putting it here and there because that's what we need to do in order to protect some of the settlements that we're keeping and also Israel itself from, let's say, high ground that's in the West Bank. The Palestinians and a lot of international observers don't really believe that, and they think that once it comes down to final talks, that's where the border will de facto be. The Israelis still say that that's not the case.
Another caller joins us now, Dave in Needham, Massachusetts.
Hi. Thanks for taking me in.
Sure.
I think that this plan represents an important opportunity. There's a lot of moderation being shown. And I think that also applies on the Israeli side, and I hope that it will become policy at NPR and at other news outlets to stop referring to Ariel Sharon as hard line or right wing or anything like that. He's taken a lot of heat for that over the years. It was always inaccurate. And here he is proposing a complete unilateral gift to the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip at great risk to Israeli communities on the Israeli side of the Gaza. And still you hear on NPR and other outlets, including sometimes Time, by the way, that he's a right-wing prime minister, he hates making concessions, and epithets of that like.
Well, getting back to the moderate part of your question, Dave, Matt Reese, has this brought out moderation amongst Palestinians, particularly as they look forward now to a more likely prospect of self-rule in at least a part of their land?
Well, they're still waiting to see under what circumstances physically the settlements come back to them. They'll be very angry if, for example, the Israelis demolish the buildings in the settlements before handing them over. But they're also still waiting to see exactly how their own leadership will deal with the situation. Arafat, at the moment, has said that he'll set up a committee to essentially figure out how they're going to respond on the ground, how they're going to make sure that Gaza doesn't simply get taken over by Hamas. He's trying to dialogue with Hamas. He's not having so much success. And at the same time, it's by no means certain, even amongst people very close to Arafat, that he's actually serious about that anyway. It could be simply that he's under pressure from the Egyptians, who are American allies here and who are taking a role in trying to get this disengagement plan through. It could be that he's simply under pressure from the Egyptians and therefore he's trying to play along. He has, for some time now, been doing that very thing with the Egyptians in their attempt to get a ceasefire from Hamas. It seems at the moment undecided. He could actually be trying to get things in order, or seems more likely that he's employing his usual strategy of, we might say, rigid chaos.
Matt Reese, thank you very much. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Matt Reese, Time Magazine's Jerusalem Bureau Chief. When we come back from a short break, we'll learn more about Gaza itself. We'll also speak with a spokesman for at least some settlers and a Palestinian minister. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Gaza. If you have the questions about the experience of Jewish settlers or Palestinians, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. In a few moments, we'll hear two views on the Gaza disengagement plan, but first, a little more about this place that has become so contested. We often talk about territory in the abstract. We've invited the head of a United Nations agency based in Gaza to give us a sense of this place, its heritage, its culture, economy, its climate. Joining us now from his home in Gaza is Lionel Brisson, who runs a United Nations relief agency there for Palestinian refugees. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
You've lived in Gaza now for 7 years. Describe the place a bit for us. How big an area, for one thing, are we talking about?
Well, first of all, you should know that it's a very tiny place. Gaza is 45 kilometers long and 5 to 12 kilometers wide.
So doing the math quickly in my head, roughly about 25 miles long and 5 miles or so wide.
Yeah, right. So, and it's 365 square kilometers, on which you have 1.4 million Palestinians living there. So it's an overcrowded place with a density which is one of the highest, if not the highest in the world, with the dense population density of 25,000 persons per square kilometer. And in the refugee camps, it's even the double, something like 50,000 persons per square kilometers.
And what is the terrain like? I assume it's near the Sinai Peninsula. It must be pretty dry and dusty.
Well, it is located on the seashore of the Mediterranean Sea, next to the Egypt border with the desert of Sinai and the desert of Negev in Israel. And it's a very dry place indeed. The climate is very hot in the summer and relatively warm in the winter too, with a rain season which is very short, let's say about 2 months, and when it is raining enough. So in two words, it was a desert before. There are some springs there, but there is an enormous problem of water in Gaza, due to the huge population living there, and there are not enough resource water.
Are farmers, though, able to grow vegetables and fruit?
Yes. What is produced here is mainly vegetables and fruits, oranges, citrus, grapefruits, apples, etc. But they need water for that, and it is a key issue in the ongoing confrontation. Who will control the waters? There is not enough water for the inhabitants in Gaza. And with a demographic increase, which is also one of the highest in the world, in 12 years' time, you will have 50% more inhabitants. 49% of the population here is below the age of 14.
So a population explosion is pending.
Yes, indeed. So it's already overcrowded. There is no space, no water, so there is a major problem for the near future.
If Israeli settlements are withdrawn, what kind of resources would that make available to the residents of Gaza now? And again, that's still a big if. But if they are, what would they get?
Well, first, one should know that Israeli settlements, including the security areas controlled by the Israeli army, are representing more or less a third of the Gaza Strip in terms of area. So even if the settlements are evacuated, which will certainly help the Palestinians, at the end of the day, it will not change drastically the situation here. They will have, we hope, a bit more water, a bit more space. But the Gaza Strip, as it is, cannot live without communicating with the outside world, which has always been the case since the ancient times. The first human settlements in Gaza were seen about 6,000 years ago, and it has been always a crossroads open to the Mediterranean world and to the ancient Egypt world. So now Gaza cannot live without communicating with the outside world by sea and by road. So the economy of Gaza is completely dependent on the Israeli economy, on the one hand, and on the economy of the neighboring countries.
Now, before we let you go, you mentioned, obviously, a civilization stretching 6,000 years back there. There must be a lot of biblical sites, a lot of places important to antiquity.
There are. The first traces of human settlement, as you were seen in Gaza a long, long time ago, since the Iron Age, Bronze Age, Gaza was also administered for a long time by the pharaohs, the ancient Egypt regime. So, and then the Greek also were seen there, the Phoenicians before, about 3,000 years ago. And then the Muslim, the Islamic rule came, then the Crusaders, and then the Mamluks, and so on and so forth. So the history is very rich in the region, and Gaza in particular. You can find beautiful Roman Empire, Byzantine mosaics in Gaza. Below the sand, there are some remains of Greek temples and so on and so forth. So it's a place where history has been built up.
Mr. Brisson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Lionel Brisson is director of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. He spoke to us from his home in Gaza. Now, two views on Prime Minister Sharon's plan for withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. Joining us from Beersheba in Israel is Shaul Goldstein. He's the mayor of Gush Etzion and deputy chairman of the Yesha Council, a group of Jewish communities in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. Good of you to speak with us today on Talk of the Nation.
Hello to you.
What is your reaction to the planned withdrawal of settlers and soldiers from the Gaza Strip?
First of all, I must correct some of the details that is there before me. Jewish settlements, Jewish communities are sitting in about 9% of the area. And the second is that about 3,000 years ago, Jews lived in Gaza, and there are a beautiful, beautiful synagogue inside Gaza. But the rest of the details are correct. My opinion about this unilateral withdrawal is that it is going to eliminate the possibility to stop the terror. Gaza is one of the greatest terror bases around the world, and they're manufacturing weapons and ammunition. And you know that Karine A, the ship,
yes,
that because of this ship, Bush, the President Bush, stopped talking to Arafat, was supposed to be delivered to Gaza Strip. So we are fearing that Gaza Strip is going to become an infrastructure for missiles against the Jewish cities all over Israel.
According to public opinion polls, the majority of Israeli citizens now say it is time to leave Gaza.
I don't believe those polls, because before the referendum of the Likud members, all the polls said that we're going to lose 14 points, and we won 20 points. So the biggest referendum ever made, 100,000 residents of Israel voted 60% towards 40% against this plan. And I believe that if Mr. Sharon will make a referendum in the entire nation in Israel, we're going to win just as well.
Are these financial considerations that we're hearing about, are those significant? The proposed payments of, about $300,000 in American money for settlers who choose to leave?
Zionism is not about money. When we came back to the land of Israel, we came back to settle here because we believed this is the only place for the Jewish people. Money did not bring us in, did not bring us here, and money won't let us go away. My father escaped from the Holocaust in 1939 from Austria, Vienna. My mother ran out of Syria, Damascus, and they both came to establish the Jewish state in the Middle East because for thousands of years, the Jewish people lived here, and compensation to them is other questions. And we think we should be there. And I don't understand why, in order to have some kind of mutual understanding or coexistence, it must be Judenrein, a place that Jews cannot live. Why Arabs can live in Israel and Jews cannot stay in Gaza Strip, which are about 10 miles away from Gaza?
It's a long way between now and when or if this plan is enacted. But if it does go ahead, what are you going to do?
It's a good question. First of all, we want to see how the Prime Minister is going to pass his vote in the Knesset, in our parliament, because if he's going to make some tricks and buy some ministers or members of Knesset, it will reduce the legitimacy of the decision. We hope he's not going to do it, and we're going to fight in the political arena, and we're doing it every day. And we feel that most of the parties are cracking right now, and understanding that the elections are near. And we hope that Sharon will leave his post and give some stronger leader to lead us and be against this very dangerous plan, as we believe it's to Israel.
I wonder, Ariel Sharon has long been a champion of the right in Israeli politics. Do you feel that he has betrayed you?
No, in Israel, since some lunatics murdered the late Mr. Rabin, we don't use this phrase, betrayed. But we think that he lost his faith in the strength of the people of Israel. We think that what he thinks is the international pressure, he must obey to it. I think he's wrong. I think the entire world understands that fighting terror is not giving them a reward, not giving them prizes. And I think Sharon is misreading the whole picture. And because of that, I think weak leaders to the state of Israel are not adequate to us. And the Israeli people must replace his prime minister, who thinks that the people is weak.
If there's going to be another election, do you think that Prime Minister Sharon could win?
It's another good question. I cannot tell you. I'm not a prophet. But as it seems like today, if he's going to form a new central lefty party, maybe he can win the elections. But if not, I think Netanyahu will win them. And this is what we hope.
That would be Benjamin Netanyahu, the previous prior former prime minister. Shaul Goldstein, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for you, and good luck.
Thank you. Shaul Goldstein is mayor of Gush Etzion, deputy chairman of the Yesha Council, and he spoke to us from Beersheba in Israel. Joining us now is Hassan Gatib. He's labor minister in the Palestinian Authority cabinet and co-editor of bitterlemons.org, a website that presents Israeli and Palestinian viewpoints on the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and peace process. And good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
I know that when this pullout from Gaza and parts of the West Bank was first proposed, many Palestinians were skeptical and opposed it. Opinion has changed, has it not?
Not oppose it, because nobody would oppose any Israeli attempt to evacuate or to withdraw from any part of the Palestinian Authority. But the Palestinians were skeptical, and to a certain extent they are still skeptical, at least because of the continuous compromising of the original plan of disengagement of Sharon, because the original plan is a compromise anyhow, because it deals with Gaza and leaves the continuity of settlement expansion and occupation consolidation in the West Bank. But even this compromise was further compromised because of the differences between the different components of the right-wing government in Israel. So what is left is really insignificant, but yet nobody will say no to any Israeli withdrawal from any part of the occupied territories, but when it happens.
We're talking about the plan to withdraw from the Gaza Strip Israeli settlements and from parts of the West Bank. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Minister Khatib, I know if there is an Israeli withdrawal from Gaza, many are concerned about the possibility of a power vacuum there. An argument between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas.
I don't think so. I think if there is going to be a withdrawal from Gaza, the Palestinian Authority is going to be able to assume responsibility and authority there. There is going to be, however, a major problem for whoever is going to take over because of the economic difficulties there. Because Gaza, which is part of the Palestinian occupied territories, is not viable economically when it is separated from the rest of the Palestinian territories, West Bank and Gaza Strip. So Israel is planning to leave Gaza and to keep it under siege, which is going to leave Gaza strangled economically, and that will require a lot of international aid until a comprehensive solution that will bring to an end the Israeli occupation to the rest of the Palestinian occupied territories, and then West Bank and Gaza Strip can be economically viable.
Let's get a caller in. Jessica was with us from Palo Alto in California.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Excellent show.
Thank you.
You sort of almost answered my question just this minute. My question is, what can some of the especially oil-rich Arab nations like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Libya, do to help make, if the disengagement plan goes through, to help make the Gaza Strip economically viable? What types of dollars are we talking about would need to be given to really help make that area a place where people can live and thrive?
Minister Khatib?
Yeah, well, the main problem in Gaza now, and it will continue during the possible disengagement, is the unemployment. One-third of the Palestinian labor force is unemployed. So we have to find jobs for 50,000 Palestinians unemployed in order to bring down the unemployment into 10%, which is more or less normal in this part of the world.
Okay.
But the problem is not only money, because we might be able to get this amount of money from Arab donors and other international donors. The problem is that as long as Israel will keep Gaza under siege, whereby commodities cannot be exported or imported, which is the situation now, which seems to be also the situation according to this plan, then no matter how money we put in terms of foreign aid, we will continue to be not able to sustain economic development and newly created jobs. So there is a need for arrangements in which the Palestinian entity, this Gaza, would be open economically to the rest of the Palestinian territories and to the outside world.
The world.
In this regard...
Sorry.
That's okay.
And keep it
very quick, Jessica.
Yeah, my only point is I think the reason that Israel is loath to open it up is they're very much afraid for their citizens' safeties. I think they have a good reason to be a little bit afraid for their citizens' safety, and I think they aren't going to be able to open Gaza up to that kind of economic give and take to the other territories until...
Jessica, you're asking the next set of questions for another program, but they're very good ones. We thank you for them.
Thank you so much.
And Minister Khatib, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Hassan Khatib is Labor Minister in the Palestinian Authority Cabinet and co-editor of the website bitterlemons.org. When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking about the story of an Iraqi teenager who turned his own father in to the U.S. military and about what may happen to him now. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.